Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Now, if you appreciate Issues Etc., please consider making a tax-deductible gift today. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
One of the things it's always struck me as a little odd, people who don't have a lot of interest in church or don't even really have any affiliation whatsoever with church, when it comes marriage time, when it comes time for a wedding, even if they've been cohabitating for years, they want their church wedding, or at least it has been that way for a long, long time. They dream of the church wedding. They want to see the stained glass. They want to have that setting. There are a lot of pastors find that very frustrating. People come and say, "Can I get married at your church?" Their interest is not in the church, but it's really just another venue to them. But something has changed. You might have seen this story from Yahoo News. Millennials aren't going to the chapel when they get married. What is that all about? And how has the media covered that story with its rather obvious religious angle? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Thursday afternoon. It's the 22nd of October. Terry Mattingly is going to join us here in the first half hour. We're going to talk about millennials and church weddings. A little bit later, Dr. Robert Gagnon, author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice and associate professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, going to join us to talk about the church's response to transgenderism, responding in particular to a Christianity Today piece that appeared back in June this summer. And it was proposing a middle way for the church. The church maybe should recognize people who want to be recognized as the opposite sex as the opposite sex. We'll see what Dr. Robert Gagnon has to say about that. Then Pastor Ted Giese joins us. We'll review the movie Bridge of Spies, and then we'll do Christ in the Old Testament, the shortest book of the Old Testament, 22 verses, I believe, the book of Obadiah. Where is Christ in those 22 verses? We'll answer that question with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Now, you can join us for the next 2 hours with questions or comments, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at @issuesetc. Or our beloved on-demand listeners, use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about millennials and church weddings, Terry Mattingly, the regular guest. He's senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
You have written recently and thought recently about the Manhattan Marriage Bureau. What's going on there, and what's newsworthy about it?
Well, the story struck me as really interesting in that, I mean, here you are in Lower Manhattan in a very secular environment, and this is a story about the fact that New York is trying to kind of compete with Vegas and other locations as a destination place to have your wedding, except, of course, it's a wedding before a justice of the peace, and there's been a boom in weddings there once New York established same-sex marriage. So you have all of these trends that you would think of as kind of secular in nature, yet they're trying at the same time to make it look like a wedding. So you have a chapel, it's called a chapel, and then you have the justice of the peace is standing there. And I wondered why the New York Times didn't explore any of kind of the religious overtones of this, because frankly, I think we live in a very interesting era, both for the redefinition of weddings, but at the same time, kind of the redefinition of a rite that for previous generations was primarily thought of as religious, but now it's kind of religious on our own terms. Does that make sense?
So there are, is it right to say there are vestiges of some kind of a nod to religion, even in places like the Manhattan Marriage Bureau?
Yeah, I mean, the whole point, the word chapel, if you look it up in a dictionary, the word chapel is religious. There's no question. I mean, the whole idea of a state-run secular chapel is a contradiction in terms in the English language. I mean, but you're dealing, you know, I'm going to the chapel and I want to get married. That sort of thing is built in deep. And what this suggests to me is people still want the blessing of the religious heritage, but once again, they want it on their own terms. And this continues a trend that we've seen in American life for at least the last generation or two, which is a kind of, I mean, beyond Free Church Protestantism, this is a kind of define-it-yourself religion, which sociologists began calling Sheilaism, after a famous case study involving a word, Sheila, in which she said that her faith was her own little light inside her, and she called it Sheilaism. And to some degree, that's the religion of Oprah. That's the religion of a lot of what you see on the typical spirituality shelf in an American bookstore. But when you take that spirituality to your wedding, you still want the white dress and you still want something called a chapel. It's not enough just to show up. For most people, it's not enough to show up in front of the justice of the peace. You want that sense that this is blessed somehow. And I found that particular article really intriguing, and it immediately fit in to some other articles that I've been reading lately on trends related to this, one of which is kind of fun but to talk about, which is the whole trend toward the incredibly racy, sexy, white wedding dress, which is the big trend right now.
Okay, so you're going to have to explain this to us, because most of us, when we picture the typical bride, and, you know, Papa culture is full of shows about nothing except about women going to pick out wedding dresses, entire shows devoted to picking out wedding dresses. And generally speaking, they... while some of them, you know, kind of vary in their cleavage meter, they're at least given appearance of being somewhat demure. What's going on here?
And this is the point. The traditional symbolism, which feminists have attacked for a long time, was that the whole purpose of the white wedding dress and the whole thing is kind of demure, and the veil, and then, you know, the father lifts the veil, you know, and hands his daughter to the male, all of this patriarchal symbolism. The white wedding dress at that point is a symbol of purity and kind of, not humility, obviously, not dragging a train, you know, down the center aisle, but the whole thing is respectability, beauty, honor, and, frankly, modesty. In other words, you're symbolizing a great moment of transition, which in the past meant the establishment not only of a marriage, but also of the marriage bed, which brings us now to an era in which cohabitation has become so much the norm, and our churches are all wrestling with the question of what does the pastor do when doing premarital counseling for a couple that he's well aware has been cohabitating for 2, 3, 4, 5 years or longer. This is one of the issues being discussed right now in the Vatican Synod on the Family, and the Pope even mentioned the era of financial and social pressures preventing marriages, which is kind of a way of hinting at cohabitation, in his address to Congress. So everybody is aware that this is the norm, but churches are all flustered. Pastors are flustered trying to figure out how you handle this in practice. I mean, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, again, my own faith, the normal practice when presented with a couple who have been cohabitating for X amount of time, the normal practice in the Eastern Orthodox Church is to ask them to separate, to cease sexual relations for a period of time, and you go to confession and you do other things to try to put yourself back on a footing in line with the church's teachings before you get married. That would be considered cruel to heretical, you know, in the religion of Oprah, you know, in the religion of Sheilaism. And churches have fallen all along the spectrum, just look the other way, don't ask, don't tell. So anyway, symbolizing this is, I was intrigued by this New York Times story, for which the art was pretty demure, but I would go ahead and warn listeners not to Google the phrase racy wedding dresses or something like that. You're probably going to get more of an eyeful than you want. But the simple fact of the matter is, one of the hottest trends right now in wedding fashion is extremely revealing wedding dresses. Now, stop and think about this for a second. What's the point of that? Not just in contrast to the previous symbolism of the wedding dress, what is the fiancé, what's the wife communicating? I mean, the story specifically mentioned the problem of wearing these dresses at public rites that involve your grandparents, you know, little children bearing the rings and all that, and you've got, you know, a neckline cut all the way past your belly button, legs exposed all the way up the sides, and strategically located transparent material, we'll just leave it at that, you know, at various parts of your anatomy. In wedding symbolism, what's the point? Where do you wear that dress? And what is it that you're saying to the public, not to mention the fact, what are you saying to your fiancé, your husband? Well, you want to take a stab at that? I have my own theory, but what do you think that that wedding dress means?
Well, I'm going to take a stab. I think it is a very, very fancy outdoor lingerie.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's kind of front-loading the wedding night, perhaps. Or
except you've been sleeping together for 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years.
Right. So
right?
I mean, that raises more questions than it answers. What do you think? I mean,
so that's what I'm asking. So what, in the era of cohabitation, are you trying to prove to the male that you're still worth taking? In a bizarre way, is this like some sort of highly sexist statement? Instead of kind of like female empowerment, wow, look at me, I am really, really hot. What's the subliminal message being sent here? You're competing for your husband on your wedding day? For his attention and his attraction? Isn't that an interesting signal? So in the column, or in the post, I should say, I raised a simple question. And just, I hope this gets laughter from you and sad laughter from listeners. Do churches need to establish a dress code for weddings?
I mean, to me, that's not a funny question. It seems to be a foregone conclusion. I imagine there are many that already have.
Okay. So we've reached the point where now, beyond the issue of premarital counseling and beyond the issue of entering into a wedding, we now have to actually try to legislate how sexy the wedding is. I find that just really fascinating because it's such a mixed – now, I'm sure a lot of these things are – the mixed signal I was going to say is there, but I'm sure a lot of these dresses are not worn in churches. But I'll bet some of them are. So you're trying in other words, I guess I'll return to the same question. What's the point? What are you saying to your parents? What are you saying? Or is this simply one-upsmanship? This is, on my wedding day, this is what I think our culture says I should look like. And if that's the case, wow, we really have crossed several Rubicons, you know, on our way to a new land.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation of millennials and church weddings. The millennials don't see the need for the chapel, even though when they show up in Manhattan at the Marriage Bureau, they're still calling it a chapel. We're discussing all of that with Terry Mattingly, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Concordia Publishing House's annual warehouse sale is both online and in store. Take advantage of discounted prices on many of the items you hear promoted on Issues Etc. November 4th through 10th. And join us for a live broadcast from CPH on Thursday afternoon, November the 5th. Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale online and in store, cph.org, and 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale, November 4th through 10th.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about millennials and church weddings. Terry Mattingly, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College and founder and editor of GetReligion.org, is our guest. Okay, you alluded to this before, but the Yahoo News story here's the headline: millennials aren't going to the chapel when they get married. What is this story? How does it figure into our conversation, Terry?
Well, there's at least two things going on there, in my opinion. One is the whole trend to the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, which is the rising percentage of young Americans who say they have no specific religious tradition. And if you have no specific religious tradition, then there are no rules for where you have your wedding, correct? I mean, at that point, if the most important thing in your life is a craft brewery, why not have your wedding there? I mean, it symbolizes what you take most seriously in life. Which is, in a sad sort of way, the flip side of the whole trend to sort toward designer caskets. You know, with the people, you can buy yourself a licensed Led Zeppelin casket. There are NASCAR caskets with your favorite driver's number on them. I mean, the baby boomers are, sometimes we have a tendency to be rather embarrassing. But this trend is of kind of designer life events has been around for a while, but it seems to be escalating because there are less and less inhibitions about the religious nature of some of these events. However, I bet you a dollar that at a lot of those weddings that are held in unusual circumstances, you still probably have, for the sake of the parents or whatever, a non-denominational rent-a minister or something like that. And there's still going to be quite a bit of traditional wedding symbolism there. So you have the vaguely spiritual nuns. The other thing is, even for religious couples that are going to be married by a priest or whatever, I think there is a tendency toward the destination wedding. And, of course, the image you immediately see in your mind is the couple standing on a cliff with the sun going down into the ocean, you know, and the waves lapping and birds flying by and all that. And so it's a religious wedding, but it's held at a location that stresses kind of lifestyle and fun and we did it our way sort of thing. So to some degree, all of this is a part of a general trend of American individualism, which says this wedding is not a sacramental event involving the body of Christ represented by my congregation, which is going to stand around me as we form this union, which is done by God, not by the state. All of these things that used to go into a liturgical wedding, that's just all not what an American wants today. This is a big moment in my life. I'm doing it my way.
Well, and it's not only that. I would add to that, Terry, and I want to know what you think about it. The purpose of inviting people to the wedding, at least in kind of a theological sense, is to say this is a public act. You know, it's done this is not being done secretly. We're doing this, and we are making these vows publicly, these promises publicly as well. Now it seems, instead of saying to the whole community / congregation, you are part of this sacred act that God is performing, we're simply inviting people to come and watch. It's voyeurism more than anything else.
Yeah, and we're a couple of decades kind of into the tradition of some people writing their own vows, which is like three steps away from the most ancient Christian traditions. The Orthodox wedding ceremony, which I'm sure you'll be stunned to know, has hardly changed at all, in a lot of different circumstances. I guess you can have flashy Orthodox weddings, but the typical Orthodox wedding is still done very much by the book. The couple has almost no choice of what goes into it. You do the hymns for the day, you do the readings for the day, you do the liturgy, you're married. And what's interesting in there is, in an Orthodox wedding, there really aren't any vows in terms of turning and looking the spouse-to-be in the face and taking vows. The vows in the ceremony are all to God. I mean, in other words, the actor in this drama is God is creating your wedding. God is creating your marriage. You will be the king and queen of your own home, wearing crowns of martyrdom, because you will give your life for each other, and God is creating this thing. That's just not very American, is it?
No, not at all.
So I think all of this is like on a continuum. And you start off with kind of wild clothing in terms of opulent clothing, big tuxes and big hair and all that. You start off at kind of the American wedding of the 50s and the 60s, and it's like the arrow just keeps ticking further over to where you end up in designer, racy, sexy weddings held, at the craft bar, beer bar of your own choice, whatever. It's like it's more and more and more and more and more about you and your lifestyle choices that you're proclaiming to the world. With Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. Which from a Christian theological perspective, it would be hard to get further away from the original meaning of marriage as the union of two families, with God creating a new family out of this, and, all the theology that goes with that.
Returning briefly to the subject of the dress we were talking about before the break, Susan emails and says, a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod minister that married us 16 years ago made me bring a picture of my wedding dress during the counseling sessions. He would have to veto an inappropriate dress. Also, he was visibly relieved when he learned that the 42 and 34-year-olds were not living together before the wedding. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. No, I mean, I have no doubt that this is happening. And since we're talking about journalism in the context of Get Religion, don't you think that would be a very interesting story to go around to some of the major temples and synagogues and cathedrals and parishes and megachurches of your area and sit down with the pastor or sit down with whoever coordinates weddings and say, what is your policy on cleavage? I mean, isn't that a lead you want to see a journalist write?
Yeah, cleavage and hemlines, because that's what it comes down to. in a lot of cases.
Except the hemline is what's the shape of the hemline. I mean, everybody wants it. You know, for the most part, nobody's that. You know, you don't have a whole lot of people wearing mini dresses to these things. It all has to do with the shape of the dress and what it reveals, because it's still supposed to be a wedding gown. But so there must be some really interesting wordings out there for these policies. And didn't that just sound like a fun story? I mean, tragically, isn't that a fun story?
How much of this is, with about a minute here, how much of this is shaped by kind of the archetypal wedding? I'm thinking about Charles and Diane, the ones that get shown on television, where that's what we're aiming for, but we miss it because what we think they're really doing there is expressing themselves, when kind of the last thing, what was happening in a royal wedding, is self-expression. It's a state event. But we want it to be as close to a state event as we can make it.
Well, but see, except that there, that's the 50s wedding on steroids, right? That's the religious symbolism, the beautiful but humble, modest white dress, the man in the tux. That's the super wedding version of the old traditions. To some degree, that's not what we're talking about at the chapel, in Lower Manhattan. That's not what we're talking about with R-rated wedding dresses, to where you're all but flashing your husband-to-be as you come down the aisle with your dad walking you. I mean, that's not what's going on in Westminster Abbey. And that's not the old dream of the super wedding. This is something totally new. And frankly, just kind of with a whiff of paganism to it, except that may be giving paganism a bad name. This is like celebrity, weird, gossip magazine wedding attire, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all about the self.
Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He authors the Weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and he's founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thank you very much for being our guest.
Glad to do it.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Dr. Robert Gagnon. We're going to talk about the church's response to transgenderism. There was a piece in the summer's, Christianity Today, that proposed a middle way for the church when it responds to transgenderism, including calling he's, she's, and him's, hers, and vice versa. We'll get a reaction from Dr. Robert Gagnon right after this.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran Music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, "A changeless Christ for a changing world." While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in His church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
Quality, quantity, qualified. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Bridgeton, Missouri; Calvary Lutheran, Elgin, Illinois; Advent Lutheran, Zionsville, Indiana; Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas; Holy Cross Lutheran, Albany, Oregon; St. John's Lutheran, Evanston, Indiana; Mount Calvary Lutheran, San Antonio, Texas; Good Shepherd Lutheran, Boise, Idaho; Village Lutheran, Ladue, Missouri; Emmanuel Lutheran, Osceola, Iowa; St. Paul Lutheran, Clarinda, Iowa; Trinity Lutheran, Lebanon, Missouri; Mount Calvary Lutheran, Excelsior Springs, Missouri; the Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California; Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Freeburg, Illinois; and Peace Lutheran, Neenah, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues, Etc. 300.